Thank you. First, I want to thank those that are responsible for me being here. I guess Keith owns this thing, so. He's the one that called me. But thank him and Sue and all of you for being here. This has been a great experience for me. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't know that I was going to be up at the North Pole. If I came out of sunny California, it'd be around 60 or something like that. And I didn't know it was 60 below. If I look a little sleepy this morning, it's because I am. I had problems last night getting a good night's rest. Along about 1:30 or 2 o'clock this morning, some middle-aged broad, about 17, 18 years old, was beating on my door and screaming, and she wouldn't shut up, and I had to get up and let her out. I thought I'd just kind of visit with you this morning. I'm going to have to leave and get back down to where it's warm. And again, I'm really truthful when I say this has been a great experience for me. Really a tremendous experience. You're a good group. You got a lot of enthusiasm. And I think that's important. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Franklin Williams.
Hi.
By the grace of God, the fellowship with men and women like you, and because this program works, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink today, and for this I'm most grateful. I was born at a very young age, and from all reports, I was sober. And I went along for 16 years without any problem. I didn't need the church to stay sober. I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober. I was just a happy-go-lucky kid. And then all of a sudden, when I was 16 years old, I had a slip. And it lasted 29 years. And I, by your standards, I was old when I took my first drink. But I was 16 years old. And I know a lot of kids in AA now that got sobriety, several years of sobriety, and not over 16 years of age. But when I was coming along, all the things that you had access to, we didn't have, or I didn't have access to. I didn't know about all these pills, and I didn't know about all these other things. All I knew about was corn whiskey. We didn't have what we call seal whiskey down in my area then. And the only thing that I ever had to drink back then was wine and homebrew and corn whiskey. And I got to where good corn whiskey I could smack my lips and really enjoy it. I cultivated the taste for it. Of course, there was a lot of corn whiskey that was floating around that wasn't good. But there was some of it that was extra good. And of course, it did the same thing that any drug does. It carried the message. And that's what I was looking for. I was an alcoholic in retrospect. I can see that I was an alcoholic from the word go. I thought for a long time that I enjoyed several years of social drinking. But really, I don't know what social drinking is. I don't understand it. And I certainly didn't do any social drinking. And the reason I know that I was never a social drinker, because I drank compulsively from that very first time. I didn't know how to drink. And they had poured, we'd two brothers, not my brothers, but two brothers and I, stole some whiskey from their father, old corn whiskey. And we poured it up in quart fruit jars. And so they offered me a drink. And I didn't want them to know that I'd never had anything to drink. I said, oh, yeah, I love that stuff. So I turned it up, and I didn't know you'd just take a swallow or two. I tried to drink it all. and I gagged and I ran around that old Model T car and kicked the wheels and gagged some more and said, ain't it good? give me some more. Well, I didn't stop drinking till all the whiskey that we had with us was gone. Now these two brothers, they stopped. They didn't continue on drinking. So I drank compulsively from the very first. I don't think social drinkers do this. I passed out on the first time that I drank. And I don't think social drinkers do this. So I went along for a period of, well, of course, to begin with, it wasn't near as bad as it was later on. As with all of us, the more I drank, the longer I drank, the more the thing progressed. And I reached a point where I had absolutely nothing. I'd lost a wife, I'd lost a home, I'd lost everything that I had. All I had was the clothes on my back. And I still didn't recognize that I had a problem. It was other people. If people had just quit picking on me and the place I was working, if they didn't all have it in for me because I had so much more ability than they did, is what I thought, well, I too could drink. And I finally reached that point where I think each and every one of us have to reach before we can make any progress in this. I surrendered. And I still think that surrender is the most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just gave up. I quit fighting. And that judge telling me to either go to Alcoholics Anonymous or go to the penal farm was the greatest message that could have been given me at that time. So as I told you last night, I went to that penal farm and I stayed out there the required length of time that I was sentenced for. I didn't get out a day earlier or a day later. And I was unemployable. All the jobs I'd had required me to be bonded. And with my background, the amount of money that I'd stolen and other things that I'd done, well, no bonding company would take me. And finally, after many months, and I'm grateful for this, because had I been able to step right into a good job, that ego would have returned and I'd have been back drinking. But some men went my bond and I got a little old job. And it was very little. It was just enough to where I could get a place to stay. And I was staying at the YMCA, not the YWCA, but the YMCA. And the room was so small it had the picture of a chair painted on the wall. And it didn't have a closet, but I didn't need a closet because I didn't have anything to put in that closet. And I was just a block from the downtown central group that stayed open from around 8 o'clock in the morning until around 12 o'clock at night. Now, I'd meet my sponsor every morning up at the club. And we'd have coffee and 12-step calls would come in. That was before we had a central office. 12-step calls would come in, and David and the others would take me on these calls. And as I told you last night, I always wanted to know what was I supposed to say. Now, you don't say nothing. You're just a horrible example. They'll look at you and we'll tell if they keep on drinking, they're going to look like you. And he says, you're serving a purpose in AA. And I said, well, I ain't enjoying it too doggone much. But that was good for me. I think it takes what it takes for each and every one of us. Some of us have a lower tolerance of pain than others. It seemed that I could take a whole lot, and I did take a whole lot. And I'm one of those, I think, that just barely did make it. I hear people say they drank too much for too long. They have a right to say that, but I don't think that's what happened with me. I drank just enough, just long enough. I think one drink more would have been too many. One drink less would have been too little. I drank exactly the same amount that I needed to get me here. And I'm grateful for this time that I spent on the streets. I'm grateful for this time that I sat around that club room. And that's where I began to get outside of myself. They'd take me on 12-step calls, and the next morning I couldn't wait to get back up there and find out from David how that old boy was getting along. Because we, as I told you, we'd have places. We couldn't get them in the hospital. So we'd give them some formaldehyde. And we'd stay with them, because if we gave them enough of it, well, they'd really get tanked up. But just a teaspoon, I forget which. We'd give them that, and in 15 minutes, heck, they could eat a hamburger. It was powerful stuff. But we smelled it. We smelled like formaldehyde. And if you've ever smelled it, you know what it is. I'm going to visit with you a little bit about what they made me do. And I've been asked, how do you start out sponsoring a person? Well, everybody don't do it the same way. I do the way that I was done, because I know it works. And it comes from the big book. So I think it's awfully hard to go wrong if we go by the big book. And we start them out as David started me out on the doctor's opinion. Now he said, I know you're going to jump over the back and want to read them juicy stories. He says, I'm not going to tell you not to do it, because if I tell you not to do it, you're sure the devil's going to do it. But he says, when you get through rummaging around back there, get back to that doctor's opinion. And before I got into the doctor's opinion, I found out what the purpose of the book was. And on Roman numeral number 13, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are many thousand men and women who have recovered. I hear a lot of controversy about being recovered or not recovered, who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Recovered from what? A seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And that's what Tradition 5 tells us. That the primary purpose of every group is to carry the message to the suffering alcoholic. And it tells me who I'm supposed to carry this message to. Not to somebody in pregnant father's deal, or Fatty Anonymous, all this stuff. I care to alcoholics alone. The reason this program, one of the main reasons this program works so well, is that we have a common problem, alcoholism, and we have a common solution, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not saying that it won't help anybody that takes this. It will. But I can't identify with someone who has problems other than alcohol. So I think there's a place designated for those people to go. We keep our group according to the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that I was a moral leper from what I had been told. Dr. Silkworth told Bill that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So there I found out that it wasn't just my mind that's all screwed up, that my body was also screwed up. And I found out what alcoholism is. Not alcohol wasm, but alcoholism. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcoholics, of alcohol on the chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. That's the thing, in my opinion, that separates me from the social drinker, is that allergy. The phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving. The social drinker don't have that phenomenon of craving. And I can't understand why they'll take a drink and sip on it all night, and then the next morning get up and not want some. I think they're sick. They're sick people. Why in the world do they even want to drink if they're not going to drink like us? It says, frothy emotional seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these people must have depth and it must have weight. I'm finding in our area, with you young people coming out of treatment centers, the ones that I'm familiar with, you're hungry for the truth. And the truth is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says it has to have width and it has to have weight, depth and weight. And certainly this program does have it. And if we just continue to expose these new people coming out of treatment centers to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll have a lot more success with people staying sober. Because there's some of them that come out of treatment centers at home that go to some of these groups, I don't know what they are. As I said last night, they may be BB, but they sure ain't AA. They talk about everything except what's in this big book. And I don't think we're giving these people a fair shot at it. I found out why I drank. I thought I drank because I loved the taste of whiskey. And David says, you like the taste of Coca-Cola, but you don't drink near as much Coca-Cola as you do booze. And says, why? So he had me to read here that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate between the true and the false. Did any of you reach that point? They are restless, irritable, and discontented. I don't know whether you ever reached that point or not, but I imagine you did by your presence here. They again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking a few drinks. Drinks which others often take with impunity. I couldn't drink with impunity or anybody else. And after having succumbed to desire again, as many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through that well-known stage of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Now, if you can't identify with this, you don't have any business being here. There's very little hope of his recovery without a psychic change. Now, you've got to realize who made this statement and when it was. Dr. Silkworth, back in 1934. At that time, psychiatry didn't believe any of this jazz that we have today. It all came from the old Freudian thing. And Dr. Silkworth was really going out on a limb to come out with such a statement that would reach the other people in the medical profession. But he had a strong enough belief, and it worked with enough alcoholics to see that no medical treatment or nothing they had ever used was successful. And there had been just a few cases of a complete psychic change. Going back to Dr. Young, Roland Hazard, from a wealthy family up east. His family had sent him to Dr. Young. And he stayed there for quite a length of time. Went through all the psychiatry that Dr. Young could offer him. And he thought, now I know all about this. I won't have to drink anymore. He left and immediately got drunk. So they sent him back up there. And Roland was really desperate. And he told the doctor, said, isn't there some way that a fellow like me can find a way to stay sober? And he said, there have been rare instances where a complete psychic change has occurred. And Roland said, well, I'm real active in the church. I'm a good church member. And Dr. Young told him that wasn't a deal. And I understand that Roland, on a train from I forget where to where, but he was reading a book and had a sudden spiritual experience. And he never had another drink from then until he died. And he is the man who called on Ebby. And then Ebby is the man who called on Bill. So I really believe that Alcoholics Anonymous dates back to when Roland Hazard was in Switzerland under the care of Dr. Young. And I can trace my sobriety all the way from Dr. Young's thing down to Mississippi where I got the message. I know the ones that brought it from place to place, and we finally got it down in Mississippi. And an old-timer that I doubt any of you in this room knew, Dick Breen. I don't know whether you ever heard of Dick and Ruth Breen. Dick Breen brought AA to Mississippi from Washington, D.C., and he and Bill were buddies back during their drinking days in Ebby. So, I really love to talk about the doctor's opinion, but I don't want to take up too much time there because I want to get into just a little bit other. So I found out what this book is, the purpose of this book. I found out who is an alcoholic. I found out what alcoholism is, and I found out the solution, a complete psychic change. So if I really study the rest of this doctor's opinion, I'll make a big step toward admitting and becoming convinced of the first two steps of this program. Then if I go on and study the next four chapters, by that time I should be completely convinced of the first two steps. That I'm powerless over alcohol, I'm completely powerless over anything, and also the second step. I have, somebody asked me if this was the first edition of the book. No, it's not. I have one at home, but I don't take it around with me. I value it too much. There's still a few people I understand in AA that are not too honest. And that book might disappear. And I've been offered some pretty big money for it, but money wouldn't buy it. I'm leaving it when I die to a friend that I sponsor. And I know he'll appreciate it and he'll take care of it. When I came, I don't know whether I wanted what you people had or not. I don't think I did. I didn't really know what you had, but you seemed odd to me. And you kept talking about God. You kept, even though you call it a power greater than yourself, I knew you were talking about God. And I didn't like that because I profess to be an agnostic. And we agnostics just don't believe jazz like that. So I missed out on a whole lot of it, but I'm glad that that happened because the right things came along and happened that I needed from him. But I sure didn't want any more of what I had. You know, I really feel sorry for these social drinkers. I really do. They just don't know how to have a good time. And a lot of them would like to become alcoholics and join Alcoholics Anonymous because they've seen some of us come from where we were to where we are now. And they're a little bit familiar with the program and they really like it. But they don't realize that you got to drink in order to get here and not sip. Now, they don't know how to drink, but they know how to sip. Well, we don't have sippers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Gulpers, yes, but not sippers. And another thing, they don't have a stick-to-itiveness. When things really get rough and in the morning you swallow that drink and then it comes back up, and then you swallow another one, it comes back up. Now, them social sippers, they'll quit. They just don't have the intestinal fortitude to go on and try. Really, they don't have the willpower to drink. And then another thing, in order to be an alcoholic, you've got to make real split-second decisions. You got to crawl out of that bed or fall out of that bed and then crawl to the bathroom and chin up to that bowl and then real quick-like make up your mind which end you're going to put on that pot first. The wrong decision can be messy as the devil. You know, I hear some people say, and I've heard sponsors tell people they sponsor, Alcoholics Anonymous don't promise you anything except sobriety. Now, I don't know where they get that. They don't get it from Alcoholics Anonymous book or any of our conference-approved literature. They don't even get it from the Bible, and the Bible ain't conference-approved literature. I don't know where they get it, but that's not true. In the steps, right after the ninth step, on pages 82 and 83, it gives us 12 promises just from there. But that's not the only promises in the 12 steps. In the explanation of the 12 steps in our textbook, there are 49 promises in those steps alone. And another odd thing is there's not a single step after not a single promise after a thinking step. We've got 4 thinking steps. 1 and 2 and 6 and 7. And if you read, you won't find a single promise in there. All 49 promises come after one or more of the 8 remaining steps. So there are 148 altogether in your textbook. And I like to spend a little time on the promises. I don't want to go here too long because I got a long way to go and a short time to get there. On page 82, where it tells us, if we have been painstaking in this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. Now, got an old boy out telling, I think, Keith and Sue about it. Got an old boy at Memphis that every speaker that comes there, he tries to tie him up the whole time he's there to take the 4th and the 5th step with. And so I know him. I tried to sponsor him in the beginning, and I fired him before he fired me because he wasn't going to do anything that I told him. So Chuck was down there. And so I went to Chuck and told him who the boy was, and I said, if he comes up to you, you just tell him go to hell, tell him anything. And I told him what he'd been doing. And I went to this boy and I said, if you bother Chuck, I'm going to kick your behind up over your shoulder and it's going to stay there. So So the boy made it through the thing without getting to spend any time with Chuck. But Chuck told me that he called him at home. And he said, Franklin was telling me about you be amazed about these promises. You be amazed before you're halfway through. And he said, Chuck, how do I know when I'll be halfway through? And Chuck told him, you dumb so-and-so, you don't you worry about it. You'll never be halfway through. And I think that's true with a good many of us. Said, we'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. Well, if I had any freedom or happiness, it'd certainly be new, because I certainly didn't have it when I came here. I really believe as great a thing as I've gotten out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is freedom. Not freedom from the cops, not freedom from my enemies, but freedom from self. See, Bill tells us in step four that selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our problem. And in the third step prayer, I pray for relief from self, release from self. We will know and not regret the past, nor wish to shadow on it. Well, I've reached that stage. I don't want to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we'll know peace. Well, I can certainly say that I've received this to a great degree. I do understand the word serenity, and I do know peace. And first of all, I know peace with Franklin. I'm really satisfied most of the time to be with self. I enjoy being with me. And back during my drinking, I couldn't stand me. And I'd get up from here and go somewhere over there, and I wasn't satisfied. And I'd get up from there and go somewhere else, and I didn't realize what was wrong. But I was taking me with me, and I didn't like me. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will know that our experience can benefit others. Bill says, in God's hands, our dark past is our greatest asset. Not in some gossiper's hands, but in God's hands. Because with my experience, I'm able, and with your experience, you are able to go to that sick alcoholic and tell him what has happened to you. And I tell them about these old buddies of mine out at Tulsa, Oklahoma. I just love them. Some of the best AAs I know anywhere. You hear people talk about how do you make a 12-step call. Because I always read in the book what it tells me to do. I pray about it, and I read what Bill has told me, and I try to follow that as closely as I can. But old Buttermilk out there, a good buddy of mine, his wife got him to go to see an old sick alcoholic. The old boy had paper all over the floor around his cot, and so he wouldn't mess up the floor. You know why the paper was there. That old apple crate there by the bed. Buttermilk went in, began to tell this old drunk how he used to drink. And the old drunk raised up on his elbow and looked Buttermilk square in the eye and said, did you really drink that way? He said, I sure did. How could I tell you this if I hadn't been there myself? And the old boy's eyes lit up. He thought he had some hope. And then he fell back down on his back and he said, but Mr. Buttermilk, said, you don't understand. I've started the drinking in the morning. And Buttermilk says, what? He says, I've started the drinking in the morning. Buttermilk grabbed his old coffee cap and put it on and turned around and said, GD, you've gone too damn far. There ain't no help for you. And walked off. Now, this is the truth. That old drunk's wife came home, helped him shave and bathe and put on some clean clothes. He went to the program of alcoholics that meeting that night, and he hadn't had a drink since, and this is over 10 years ago. Now, how do you make a 12-step call? Buttermilk scared the devil out of that old drunk. Now, his tactic wouldn't work with everybody. And I have to tell you this about Buttermilk and Chuck. Old Chuck loved Buttermilk. And Buttermilk was introducing Chuck at the Arkansas State Convention. Chuck was the banquet speaker. Well, behind the podium, there's a partition there, and then right in that is a kitchen. We just finished the banquet, so it came time for the meeting to start, and Buttermilk wasn't available. So the boss of the convention had to get up there and page Buttermilk. So he comes out of that back part there from the kitchen with a sack in his hand, a paper sack in his hand. He set it down on the podium. He said, I heard this fella before and I brung my lunch. Then he introduced old Chuck and he says, it's been pretty good up to now. I hope old Gooba don't louse it up. Well, nobody had ever called Chuck a nut. So Chuck talked along a good while and he looked at his watch and turned to Buttermilk. He said, Buttermilk, what time is it? Buttermilk gets up. Had on a red jacket. He pulled his thing and he looked. He said, it's 20 minutes after. Chuck says, 20 minutes after what? Buttermilk brings it. He says, Chuck, I don't rightly know. The hour hand hits done run off. You ask Elsa about that sometime. So Chuck out at the International at Denver, and he was talking Sunday morning, and he says, I hope old Buttermilk's not here to introduce me. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. It certainly will. Even from the beginning, back when they said I was serving as a horrible example, I felt that there was some little place right then for me. And I didn't want to leave. Self-seeking will slip away. Now, I think that several of you in here can attest to the fact that that self-seeking is hard to disappear. But it finally does, it finally has with me. Our whole attitude on life will change. And my attitude has changed. I'm no longer just interested in old Franklin. As I told you, I'd want to get on to the club there by the time it opened every morning and find out from David how that old drunk was that we went to see the night before. And I always felt so good when David said we was going to go by and pick him up and ride around some and talk to him. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. My second sponsor, Carl Wright, he's dead. He was the second delegate from Texas, an old heavy equipment operator, a real old rough, tough character. And he spent most of his time out at the Pendle farm making crop, and then he'd go back out and help gather it. He was out there most of the time. But when he got to be a delegate, they sent him to New York. And in Texas, of course, you have a lot of delegates from California. In Texas, they had four delegates. And they sat all four of these delegates at the same table, all four of these from Texas. And then whatever else room had delegates from somewhere else. Well, Carl had more sobriety than anybody sitting at the table. And Carl never had eaten with anything except a tablespoon. You know, that's all they give you out of these joints. And had all this silverware there, and Carl didn't know what it's all about. So they serve a cocktail first. Had all them forks, and Carl didn't know which one to use. He said, well, I'll just wait till somebody else picks up one, and then I'll pick up what he did. Well, he sat, and nobody picked it up. Carl finally figured, if I'm going to eat, I'm going to have to pick up something. So he picked up a fork, started eating, and everybody else did the same thing. And Carl said, I intuitively knew how to handle a situation which used to baffle me. Said, now, before I got sober, well, I'd have gotten drunk over that deal. but I knew how to handle this situation. So that does happen with us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And that is a great revelation. When David had me to read down there in that second, in that thing in the back of the book, where many of us think that an unsuspected power has entered our lives, which we can identify with as a power greater than ourselves. This, in essence, is a spiritual awakening. When I fully understood what that said, I suddenly realized that God had done for me and was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I was told when I came in that these people here in the Quonset group are all doing what none of them could do alone, but together they were able to stay sober. And said, if you want to stay sober, you need to stay close to these people. Of course, at that time, I wasn't interested in it. That's when I was interested in slipping. And I wanted to stay close to that fellow that I was slipping with, because we had bound to find a way where we could drink and wouldn't get into trouble. See, the old mental obsession hadn't been removed. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us daily, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. Now, this is what a lot of people miss, but they will always materialize if we wait for them. If we wait for them. I told you about the number of promises in the explanation of the 12 steps. You know, it's daily, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. Now, this is what a lot of people miss, but they will always materialize if we wait for them. If we wait for them. I told you about the number of promises in the explanation of the 12 steps. You know, it's amazing how Bill had the foresight to put into that book what he put into it. Not being experienced as a writer, not being experienced as a psychologist or psychiatrist, just a plain old con artist. But yet he put something together there that has saved thousands and thousands and thousands of lives and touched many thousand families and homes. If this was a thinking program, I think Bill would have had a chapter in there in the thinking. But it's not a thinking program. He's got a chapter in there in the action. And I think that where those promises are in the 12 steps is indicative of this being an action program and not a thinking program. So there's absolutely no way in the world that this old boy can think himself into proper acting. I've got to act myself into proper thinking. Then once I act myself into proper thinking, well, then my thinking can control my action. But I think it's in that other big book, the first big book, that as a man thinketh, so is he. Well, certainly not as I was as an alcoholic, thinking so easy. This is a beautiful program, a really tremendous, beautiful program. I've been asked a lot of times by people that are interested, but yet they don't understand. They say, why is it that after all these years, you continue to go to those meetings? Some of them are church members. And I'll turn around and say, after all these years, why do you continue to go to church? And that's all I say. And I say, how many baths do you take a week? Some of them say, I bathe every day. I said, well, you shouldn't mind me going to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting every day. I need a spiritual bath, which you don't understand, just as badly as you need the bath that you take. But I go to meetings for the same reason there was a bank robber up in New York. He spent a lot of years in the federal penitentiary for robbing banks. His name was Willie Sutton. And I saw in the paper a year or so ago where Willie Sutton was in Chicago, and the tellers at the banks there are still nervous when he comes in. They know him. Now, while he was in the penitentiary, some of these brilliant psychiatrists got a hold to him, and they wrote a book on him about as thick as Gone with the Wind. And finally, after they had completed their psychotherapy, well, they called him in and they talked to him. And they said, Willie, why is it that every time you get out, you go straight and rob a bank? Willie said, it's real simple. That's where the money's at. Now, any old drunk could have told him that in 2 minutes. But there, them brilliant psychiatrists had written all that volume, and they didn't know why he was robbing them back. And they never did think to ask Willie till after they'd come to all this. So I come to AA where the money's at. And the money here is love. And I hope I'll continue to come here as long as I'm physically able to get here. You know, I was always looking for something when I was drinking, for right now, right this minute. I wanted something to take care of this situation right this minute. Not in the next 10 minutes, not the next day, but right now, right now. And this is the only place that I've ever been that's got a problem, that can take a problem that I have right now and handle that situation. This is a right now program, a right now program. And up until the advent of so many of these treatment centers, and I'm not against treatment centers because they have certainly increased the population of Alcoholics Anonymous. But up until the advent of these treatment centers, we were about the only people left that made house calls. You know, doctors used to make house calls, but very seldom do you find a doctor now that'll make house calls. Well, we in Alcoholics Anonymous, we made house calls at all hours of the night, all hours of the day. And I hate to see that disappear. It's been a long time since I've sat on an old drunk's hands. I'm just not getting those calls. They're either sent to halfway houses or they're sent to treatment centers. And we've got people in my area that seem to think if you go pick up a fella and take him to a halfway house, that you're sponsoring him. Hell, that ain't got nothing to do with it. They catch a bus and get there. they could flag a cop and tell that cop what they want, and that cop would take them. That happens a lot. So I hate for us to lose that distinction of being the only place left that does house calls. I'll close with a story an old buddy of mine used to tell. He said when the Titanic sank, said they loaded people in these lifeboats and were getting them away. And finally they got onto the last lifeboat and they had three people too many to get in there. And the captain was still on the boat. And he yelled on and told them, said that thing was overloaded and three people were going to have to jump off. Well, it was quiet for a good while. Finally, an Englishman got up and said, "Long live the Queen," and jumped overboard. So again, more silence. He said, "We got to have two more." And then an old Frenchman stood up and said, "Vive la France," and he jumped overboard. And then there seemed to be a great length of silence. "Captain," yelled, "we've got to have one more." And a tall Texan stood up and he said, "Remember the Alamo," and he grabbed the Mexican and threw him overboard. So I tell you this with all sincerity, if Alcoholics Anonymous ever gets overloaded, and the head of it, be he whoever he be, say we're overcrowded, somebody's got to jump overboard. This old boy ain't going nowhere. I ain't gonna jump nowhere. I may pick up somebody and throw him over, but I ain't leaving this deal. Thank you, and God bless you, and I've enjoyed being with you.